This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show where each time we take a trip back in time and listen to stories from our greatest generation. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so they're not forgotten, so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And not only are we educated, I believe we're inspired along the way by how much these people love our country. I'm certain that's going to be the case today with 92-year-old Irvin Cooper of Los Angeles, California. He is the author of a new book called Peter Bogey Mike, and we'll get to the significance of that title. But Mr. Cooper, I've got to ask you, first of all, you know, I meet a lot of people that are in their 80s and 90s, and you don't look 92. What's your secret? How do you get around so well and stay so young and active?
I don't know if I blame it on the Levi, but I think it's in the genes. And that, and having a wonderful wife that served balanced meals and stuff like that. She asked me to say that, so I'm putting that in, but it's true.
Well, after 69 years, I think she has a say, doesn't she?
She does, she does.
You guys are headed for your 70th anniversary in March, and we're going to talk about how you met. We're going to hear also about your adventures in the PBM Martin Mariner during World War II. But let's go back before that. I know you're born in New York. You moved out to California at a very young age. What was it like growing up in California in the 20s and 30s? What are the kind of things that you remember?
I was very fortunate to grow up with Japanese, Chinese, Black, Mexican, White Russians, Jewish, every denomination in Boyle Heights of Los Angeles, which was a very involved mixed ethnic group. I think from that I really developed a respect for other groups, and I've maintained that my whole life, and I've really enjoyed. I have friends in all the categories, and I don't look at them as that. I look at them as individuals. And to me, there's only two kinds of people, good people and bad people, and this is the creed that I followed my whole life.
Well, clearly it served you well. I know we've got a lot of stories we'll try to fit into this hour, and there are a few things I know I want to ask you about. But as a teenager, as a young man, we all have ambitions and dreams. What were some of the dreams you remember, and was flying one of them at even an early age?
I don't think flying was about the furthest thing from my mind. I don't know where a poor Jewish kid in East L.A. is thinking about flying, but I wanted to be an artist, and I wanted to be in journalism, and Walter Winchell was my idol at the time and stuff like that. I guess that was my outlook for an outside professional life, and I enjoyed athletics. Even though I was small, but I participated in everything. I was an only child, and I was much on my own, and fortunately fared very, very well.
What high school did you go to?
I went to Dorsey High School in Los Angeles when they opened it in 1938. I went to L.A. High, and then they opened Dorsey High in 38, and it was supposed to be the most modern, progressive school. It was so progressive that they let me go through school without taking language, without taking math, without taking a lot of the stuff. So I was great in woodshop, printing, journalism, and athletics and everything else. And when I graduated, I did not have anything to be able to go on to college. So in spite of the great reputation that Dorsey has, it really didn't do me very well.
So what did you do when you got out of high school?
Well, I realized that I didn't have anything, so I went on to junior college. I went on to L.A. City College. I graduated in 39. And I went to work for Lockheed Aircraft Company at 50 cents an hour, which was great.
This was up in Burbank, building P-38s?
I riveted P-38s, saved up enough money. After I acquired $900 out of a brand new Chevy Club Coupe, red, and all paid for in cash, and that was my pride.
Were you working at the Lockheed plant when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor? What do you remember about December 7th?
I was working at Lockheed, and the next morning I went to school at L.A. Junior College. I was in a print class called with Mr. Green, who was the head of the printing class, and we had a basketball team called the Green Printers. And we were playing a Japanese basketball team that day. And we went out, and neither of us knew how to behave. We played an absolute, total, silent basketball game. Nobody said anything, just played the game. We didn't know how to react to each other, because basically we're casual friends. That was December 8th.
Wow, you know, and I ask every single veteran about that because everyone remembers something, but I haven't heard that one, that they had to play a basketball game against Japanese players. And you mentioned growing up in a neighborhood where there were so many different cultures. So I imagine you had a lot of Japanese-American friends.
I did, yes.
How did what ensued after December 7th and Executive Order 9066 and the internment camps and all that, how did you see that playing out from your perspective?
Well, we reacted to what was told. We were told the Japanese people were going to do things to the United States and stuff like that, and so they were interned them. We were not sophisticated enough to realize that they were really basically American citizens, and they were, if anyone was upset, they were the ones, because their ethnic background was attacking the country in which they lived. But they were sent to Manzanar, the ones that I knew. When I joined the Navy, I was sent to Lone Pine, California for preliminary flight training. The Navy couldn't take in enough cadets to fly. They didn't have the facilities. So they sent us to a private flying school while we were waiting around. And we went to Lone Pine, California, and I used to fly over Manzanar, you know, really very odd situation.
So you would look down and see with your own eyes the conditions that your old friends were living in.
Yeah, and it was, you know, startling. And I didn't know if they were attackers of the country or not. You know, what would I know?
And speaking of, a lot of people don't realize. Everyone knows that Pearl Harbor happened, but people don't know that there were other incidents on the west coast of the mainland that happened in late 1941 and early 1942. And you know, because it's a pretty important night in your life, and it's how you met your wife, thanks to the Japanese. Without the Japanese showing up on the Pacific coast of California, you never would have met your wife. Am I getting that straight?
Am I grateful to the Japanese or not? I don't know. No, it happened, I think it was February 4th or 5th of 1942. A Japanese submarine came to Santa Barbara. It supposedly had a catapult airplane on. It was coming over to bomb Los Angeles. So every radio in the city of L.A. said, turn off your lights, close all the shade, do everything you want. On Baldwin Hills, which is not too far from where I live, near Dorsey High School, they had Hollywood Klieg lights up on top of the hills, and they were scouring the sky looking for the aircraft to come in. So I got out of my house to go to work, and I used to leave early for work, around 10 o'clock or so, and I'd go to the Hollywood Palladium or any of the nightclubs up there, and I'd stand and watch the jazz band, Benny Goodman, Tommy Dorsey, Jimmy Dorsey, all of them play, and then go on to work at Lockheed at 12 o'clock, and then get off at 7:30 in the morning and go to L.A. City College. Well, on that particular date, I left at around 10, and I pulled out. I got out, and I looked up, and the sky was completely black with stars. You know, you never see that in a city. All the lights were out, so you could be in Big Bear or Arrowhead, and it was very beautiful. I backed my beautiful $900 brand-new Chevy out, and two doors away, I see this young girl standing looking at the stars also. So I pulled over, and I said, gee, well, how pretty it is, and we had a discussion, and that's how I met my Elaine. We started to talk, and get more comfortable. I carried a convenient blanket in the back seat of the car, and I put it on the lawn. And I believe her brother was out looking from the window, make sure she was covered. But we sat on the lawn and talked, and that's how I started, and that's how we met.
But without the blackout, you never would have been out there.
No, I'd have probably just gone right on by, as I usually did.
Well, somebody must have had a plan for you, too, because 69 years later, almost 70, you're still going strong. Working in a defense industry at the Lockheed plant, I'm sure you were exempt from actually going into the military. How did it occur that you became a Navy pilot?
Well, I was so anti-war, and on San Vicente Boulevard here in Los Angeles, there were 400 wheelchairs that circled San Vicente to Wilshire Boulevard, and these were all veterans that sat there with mustard gas poisoning from World War I, and I decided that war was not for me. I was going to get a job, and I'll work, and I'll build stuff like that. However, when Pearl Harbor happened, it changed my whole attitude. Our country was attacked, and my pacifistic views turned, and I wanted to do my part. The problem is, how would I want to do it? I didn't want to become a soldier and slog around in that. I felt smarter than that. And the only way, after having met Elaine also at that time, her brothers, one was going to be a doctor in the Army, and the other was going to be an engineer in the Navy, and they would both be commissioned officers. I could not go in the Navy as a sailor and compete with this young lady's brothers. So the only way I could do it was to fly. The Army would take you in with a high school diploma, And my best friend, a fellow named Jerry Foreman, signed on right away, and he was going to be a doctor, and he was the top quarterback on the football team and the catcher on the baseball team, very athletic. And 9 months later, he was shot down in a P-38 over England. That's just a side story. I'm only telling you that because I really wanted to go in the Navy. The Army put you out in war in 9 months. The Navy had 18 months of training before you got in. So, and I always liked the ocean and Venice and the whole thing like that. But the Army was getting all the cadets, all the people recruited. The Navy, there were only so many graduates of college, so they lowered the restrictions that if you had 2 years of college and could pass this test, they would take you. So when that opened up, my best friend and I went down, took the test, passed, and joined the Naval Air Corps.
I've got to ask you also, just, you know, in retrospect, we know what was going on in the world and what was happening in the different theaters. And I know you talked about Walter Winchell, and I'm sure you heard Edward R. Murrow on the radio and you read the newspapers. But as someone of Jewish heritage, were you at all aware of what was going on in Europe and how the Jewish people were being persecuted there?
I don't think we realized that at all. But I personally didn't realize what was going on. And it was such a distant thing. And at 18, 19 years of age, you don't really concentrate on that sort of thing unless it's brought forward for you to know.
So you get into to naval aviation. And where was your relationship with Elaine at this point? Were you thinking, you know, this is the girl I'm going to marry if I get back from this war? Or what was in your mind?
I tried to date her a couple of times. And finally, she went to the movies with me a few times. We sort of clicked along. It was kind of embarrassing because the Navy hadn't taken us in, and we'd walk around in civilian clothes, and people would say, how come healthy young men like you aren't in the service, you know? So the Navy took us and said, we're going to put you into a private flying school temporarily. I mean, you part from somebody that you like, you start writing letters. And so we write letters back and forth, even though we were only a few hundred miles away. But I went through pre-flight training, and I got my little silver civilian pilot training wings, and I came back somewhat heroic because I was now competing with her brothers, and yeah, we started a date. And I think it was about the fourth or fifth date or something like that, but we got along very well. And it was my birthday on following year that I proposed.
Before you went overseas, you proposed?
Before I even finished training. Before I went in the Navy, I had about 100 hours of civilian pilot training. The whole purpose was between the writing and to coming and meet Elaine each time I was there. We became very, very close.
Well, that gave you something to come back home for once you actually had to go overseas. And I want to talk about the planes that you flew, because the title of your book indicates the plane you spent the most time in, but that wasn't the first plane you were flying. And how primitive were seaplanes in the 1940s?
Well, the seaplanes, I think they were rather sophisticated compared to the other aircraft. Coming back from the private flying school, when they finally accepted us into the Navy, they sent us to a pre-flight school, which was very difficult. And as I started to tell you earlier, my scholastic background was rather weak. And I went into a pre-flight school at Del Monte Pre-Flight School up in Monterey. And I met all these college-educated people, and I'm supposed to be with 2 years of junior college. And we took our first math class. The officer that came out, he came on the board, and he put one, and drew a line under knife and said, that means equals two. He said, this is the way we're starting. Well, the guys that had been through college were really bored silly. But in 1 day or 2 days, we went through elementary math. The next day, they went into high school math, and I went crazy trying to keep up with them. So it was very, very difficult for me, and I was very fortunate to be able to complete the course. At that point, Elaine came up to visit me in Monterey, and when they came up in an entourage. My mother came up, all the mothers of all the group that we knew came up there, and my mother brought her diamond ring that she had given me to give to Elaine, which I have in the book because it had a slight chip in it. And I proposed to Elaine, and she accepted. Elaine was a little bit disturbed because my mother had said, if the wedding doesn't go through, will you give the ring back?
I guess almost 70 years later, we can say it went through, huh?
And the chip is still there.
And what kind of thrills did you have in those early seaplane flights that you got to experience?
The biggest thrill I had is when my best friend and I, his name was Bud Plone, when we were sworn into the Navy to show how brave we were, we drove down Wilshire Boulevard to Santa Monica Pier and went on the roller coaster. And we sat in the front seat, and it was the most harrowing experience I have had in my whole life. I just wanted to show how brave we were, and I was really skeptical when we got off. And I realized the difference between a roller coaster and an airplane. An airplane, you have control. In the roller coaster, you're just sitting there going wherever it turns.
Did it ever occur to you that what you were doing might have a little danger involved in it, or that you were taking your life into your own hands, or were you just carefree and hard charging?
I don't believe I was ever carefree, and I think I was always conscious of the airplane and what it is. Of all the things, I used to do handstands and acrobatic stuff, but I could not stand acrobatics in the air. When they turned me upside down, I was completely helpless. On the other hand, on the specific stuff like landings and takes off and pylons and stuff that had to be absolutely strict, I was really terrific. So when I went through training, they would scratch their head because I did the worst acrobatics they would have, but I was about as smooth. They would cut the engine and I'd hit a circle dead center every time, and I fortunately got through. Fortunately, I never had to do acrobatics afterwards. I'd have probably never been a fighter pilot, actually. And I ended up at Corpus Christi, and they assigned me to the OS-2U, which is a Kingfisher, a single-engine seaplane. The training there was you would go out on a cruiser or battleship, and they would catapult you off, and you would fly 100 miles out to see if there was, we didn't have the radar at the time, to see if there was anything dangerous, and you would report back.
Did you ever get to do that, to get catapulted off one of those ships?
One of the big thrills I had was when I soloed an airplane at Lone Pine, and when I was catapulted off of a catapult and all that. And I must admit at that time, I'd think of myself as a little kid from Boyle Heights sitting in a Navy aircraft being shot off, and I said, my God, I would compare myself to Tyrone Power, to Clark Gable, to John Wayne. As I went along, I realized I suddenly was John Wayne, so it was very simple.
Well, and you sure look like a Hollywood movie star in some of these photos in your book. Peter Bogey Mike is the title. 92-year-old Irvin Cooper is the author. And we'll dive deeper into his story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.